he thought. I've lost a bracelet. It's not precious, just carved wood, but I'm fond of it. What a shame, Godwin said sympathetically. I'll ask all the monks and nuns to look out for it. Philemon said, I haven't seen it. Godwin said to Philippa, Perhaps it's slipped from your wrist. She frowned. The odd thing is, I haven't actually worn it since I got here. I took it off when I arrived and put it on the table, and now I can't find it. Perhaps it rolled into a dark corner. Philemon here will look for it. He cleans the guest rooms. Philippa looked at Philemon. Yes, I saw you as I was leaving an hour or so ago. You didn't spot it when you swept the room? I didn't sweep. Miss Marjorie came in just as I was getting started. Godwin said, Philemon has just come back to clean your room, but Miss Marjorie is... He looked into the room. At prayer, he finished. Marjorie was kneeling on the prie-dieu, eyes closed, begging forgiveness for her sin, Godwin hoped. Richard stood behind her, head bowed, hands clasped, lips moving in a murmur. Godwin stepped aside to let Philippa enter the room. She gave her brother-in-law a suspicious look. Hello, Richard, she said. It's not like you to pray on a weekday. He put his finger to his lips in a shushing gesture and pointed to Marjorie on the prayer stool. Philippa said briskly, Marjorie can pray as much as she likes, but this is the women's room and I want you out. Richard concealed his relief and left, closing the door on the two women. He and Godwin stood face to face in the hallway. Godwin could tell that Richard did not know what line to take. He might be inclined to say, How dare you burst into a room without knocking? However, he was so badly in the wrong that he probably could not summon up the nerve to bluster. On the other hand, he could hardly beg Godwin to keep quiet about what he had seen, for that would be to acknowledge himself in Godwin's power. It was a moment of painful awkwardness. While Richard hesitated, Godwin spoke. No one shall hear of this from me. Richard looked relieved, then glanced at Philemon. What about him? Philemon wants to be a monk. He is learning the virtue of obedience. I'm in your debt. A man should confess his own sins, not those of others. All the same, I'm grateful, Brother Godwin, the sacrist. I'm the nephew of Prior Anthony. He wanted Richard to know that he was sufficiently well connected to make serious trouble. But to take the edge off the threat, he added, My mother was betrothed to your father many years ago, before your father became the Earl. I've heard that story. Godwin wanted to add, And your father spurned my mother, just as you're planning to spurn the wretched Marjorie. But instead he said pleasantly, We might have been brothers. Yes. The bell rang for dinner. Relieved of their embarrassment, the three men parted company, Richard to dine with Prior Anthony, Godwin to the monk's refectory, and Philemon to the kitchen to help serve. Godwin was thoughtful as he walked through the cloisters. He was upset by the animal scene he had witnessed, but he felt he had handled it well. At the end, Richard had seemed to trust him. In the refectory, Godwin sat next to Theodoric, a bright monk a couple of years younger than he. Theodoric had not studied at Oxford, and in consequence he looked up to Godwin. Godwin treated him as an equal, which flattered Theodoric. I've just read something that will interest you, Godwin said. He summarized what he had read about the revered Prior Philip's attitude to women in general and nuns in particular. It's what you've always said, he finished. In fact, Theodoric had never expressed an opinion on the subject, but he always agreed when Godwin complained about Prior Anthony's slackness. Of course, Theodoric said. He had blue eyes and fair skin, and now he flushed with excitement. How can we have pure thoughts when we are constantly distracted by females? But what can we do about it? We must confront the prior. In chapter, you mean, Godwin said, as if it were Theodoric's idea rather than his own. Yes, excellent plan. But would others support us? the younger monks would. Young men probably agreed with more or less any criticism of their elders, Godwin thought, but he also knew that many monks shared his own preference for a life in which women were absent, or at least invisible. "If you talk to anyone between now and chapter, let me know what they say," he said. That would encourage Theodoric to go around whipping up support. The dinner arrived, a stew of saltfish and beans. Before Godwin could begin to eat, he was prevented by Friar Murdo. Friars were monks who lived among the people instead of secluding themselves in monasteries. They felt that their self-denial was more rigorous than that of institutional monks, whose vow of poverty was compromised by their splendid buildings and extensive landholdings. Traditionally, friars had no property, not even churches, although many had slipped from this ideal after pious admirers gave them land and money. Those who still lived by the original principles scrounged their food and slept on kitchen floors. They preached in marketplaces and outside taverns, and were rewarded with pennies. They did not hesitate to sponge on ordinary monks for food and lodging any time it suited their convenience. Not surprisingly, their assumption of superiority was resented. Friar Murdo was a particularly unpleasant example, fat, dirty, greedy, often drunk, and sometimes seen in the company of prostitutes. But he was also a charismatic preacher who could hold a crowd of hundreds with his colorful, theologically dubious sermons. Now he stood up, uninvited, and began to pray in a loud voice, "Our Father, bless this food to our foul, corrupt bodies, as full of sin as a dead dog is full of maggots." Murdo's prayers were never short. Godwin put down his spoon with a sigh. There was always a reading in chapter, usually from the Rule of St. Benedict, but often from the Bible and occasionally other religious books. As the monks were taking their places on the raked stone benches around the octagonal chapter house, Godwin sought out the young monk who was due to read today and told him, quietly but firmly, that he, Godwin, would be reading instead. Then, when the moment came, he read the crucial page from Timothy's book. He felt nervous. He had returned from Oxford a year ago, and he had been quietly talking to people about reforming the priory ever since. But, until this moment, he had not openly confronted Antony. The prior was weak and lazy and needed to be shocked out of his lethargy. Furthermore, St. Benedict had written, "All must be called to chapter, for the Lord often reveals to a younger member what is best." Godwin was perfectly entitled to speak out in chapter and call for stricter compliance with monastic rules. All the same, he suddenly felt he was running a risk, and wished he had taken longer to think about his tactics in using Timothy's book. But it was too late for regrets. He closed the book and said, "My question, to myself and my brethren, is this. Have we slipped below the standards of Prior Philip in the matter of separation between monks and females?" He had learned, in student debates, to put his argument in the form of a question whenever he could, giving his opponent as little as possible to argue against. The first to reply was blind Carlos, the sub-prior, Antony's deputy. "Some monasteries are located far from any center of population, on an uninhabited island, or deep in the forest, or perched on a lonely mountaintop," he said. His slow, deliberate speech made Godwin fidget with impatience. "In such houses, the brothers seclude themselves from all contact with the secular world," he went on unhurriedly. "Kingsbridge has never been like that. We're in the heart of a great city, the home of 7,000 souls. We care for one of the most magnificent cathedrals in Christendom. Many of us are physicians because St. Benedict said, 'Special care must be taken of the sick, so that in very deed they may be looked after as if it were Christ himself.' The luxury of total isolation has not been granted to us. God has given us a different mission." Godwin had expected something like this. Carlos hated furniture to be moved, for then he would stumble over it, and he opposed any other kind of change out of a parallel anxiety about coping with the unfamiliar. Theodoric had a quick answer to Carlos. "All the more reason for us to be strict about the rules," he said. "A man who lives next door to a tavern must be extra careful to avoid drunkenness." There was a murmur of pleased agreement. The monks enjoyed a smart riposte. Godwin gave a nod of approval. The fair-skinned Theodoric blushed with gratification. Emboldened, a novice called Jule said in a loud whisper, "Women don't bother Carlos. He can't see them." Several monks laughed, though others shook their heads in disapproval. Godwin felt it was going well. He seemed to be winning the argument so far. Then Prior Antony said, "Exactly what are you proposing, Brother Godwin?" He had not been to Oxford, but he knew enough to press for his opponent's real agenda. Reluctantly, Godwin put his cards on the table. "We might consider reverting to the position as it was in the time of Prior Philip." Antony persisted. "What do you mean by that exactly? No nuns?" "Yes, but where would they go?" "The nunnery could be removed to another location and become a remote cell of the priory, like Kingsbridge College or St. John in the Forest." That shocked them. There was a clamour of comment, which the prior suppressed with difficulty. The voice that emerged from the hubbub was that of Joseph, the senior physician. He was a clever man, but proud, and Godwin was wary of him. "How would we run a hospital without nuns?" he said. His bad teeth caused him to slur his sibilance, making him sound drunk, but he spoke with no less authority. "They administer medicines, change dressings, feed the incapable, comb the hair of senile old men." Theodoric said, "Monks could do all that." "Then what about childbirth?" Joseph said. "We often deal with women who are having difficulty bringing a baby into the world. How could monks help them without nuns to do the actual handling?" Several men voiced their agreement, but Godwin had anticipated this question, and now he said, "Suppose the nuns removed to the old Lazar House." The leper colony, or Lazar House, was on a small island in the river on the south side of the town. In the old days it had been full of sufferers, but leprosy seemed to be dying out, and now there were only two occupants, both elderly. Brother Cuthbert, who was a wit, muttered, "I wouldn't want to be the one to tell Mother Cecilia she's being moved to a leper colony." There was a ripple of laughter. "Women should be ruled by men," said Theodoric. Prior Antony said, "And Mother Cecilia is ruled by Bishop Richard. He would have to make a decision such as this." "Heaven forbid that he should," said a new voice. It was Simeon, the treasurer, a thin man with a long face. He spoke against every proposal that involved spending money. "We could not survive without the nuns," he said. Godwin was taken by surprise. "Why not?" he said. "We don't have enough money," Simeon said promptly. "When the cathedral needs repair, who do you think pays the builders? Not us. We can't afford it. Mother Cecilia pays. She buys supplies for the hospital, parchment for the scriptorium, and fodder for the stables. Anything used communally by both monks and nuns is paid for by her." Godwin was dismayed. "How can this be? Why are we dependent on them?" Simeon shrugged. "Over the years, many devout women have given the nunnery land and other assets." That was not the whole story, Godwin felt sure. The monks also had extensive resources. They collected rent and other charges from just about every citizen of Kingsbridge, and they held thousands of acres of farmland, too. The way the wealth was husbanded must be a factor. But there was no point in going into that now. He had lost the argument. Even Theodoric was silent. Antony said complacently, "Well, that was a most interesting discussion. Thank you, Godwin, for asking the question. And now, let us pray." Godwin was too angry for prayer. He had gained nothing of what he wanted, and he was unsure where he had gone wrong. As the monks filed out, Theodoric gave him a frightened look and said, "I didn't know the nuns paid for so much." "None of us knew," Godwin said. He realized he was glaring at Theodoric and made amends hastily, adding, "But you were splendid. You debated better than many an Oxford man." It was just the right thing to say, and Theodoric looked happy. This was the hour for monks to read in the library or walk in the cloisters, meditating. But Godwin had other plans. Something had been nagging him all through dinner and chapter. He had thrust it to the back of his mind, because more important things had intervened, but now it came back. He thought he knew where Lady Philippa's bracelet might be. There were few hiding places in a monastery. The monks lived communally. No one but the prior had a room to himself. Even in the latrine they sat side by side over a trough that was continuously flushed by a stream of piped water. They were not permitted to have personal possessions, so no one had his own cupboard or even box. But today Godwin had seen a hiding place. He went upstairs to the dormitory. It was empty. He pulled the blanket cupboard away from the wall and removed the loose stone, but he did not look through the hole. Instead, he put his hand into the gap, exploring. He felt the top, bottom, and sides of the hole. To the right, there was a small fissure in the stone. Godwin eased his fingers inside and touched something that was neither stone nor mortar. Scrabbling with his fingertips, he drew the object out. It was a carved wooden bracelet. Godwin held it to the light. It was made of some hard wood, probably oak. The inner surface was smoothly polished, but the outside was carved with an interlocking design of bold squares and diagonals, executed with pleasing precision. Godwin could see why Lady Philippa was fond of it. He put it back, restored the loose stone, and returned the cupboard to its usual position. What did Philemon want with such a thing? He might be able to sell it for a penny or two, though that would be dangerous because it was so recognizable. But he certainly could not wear it. Godwin left the dormitory and went down the stairs to the cloisters. He was in no mood for study or meditation. He needed to talk over the day's events. He felt the need to see his mother. The thought made him apprehensive. She might berate him for his failure in chapter, but she would praise him for his handling of Bishop Richard, he felt sure, and he was eager to tell her the story. He decided to go in search of her. Strictly speaking, this was not allowed. Monks were not supposed to roam about the streets of the town at will. They needed a reason, and in theory they were supposed to ask the prior's permission before leaving the precincts. But in practice, the obedientaries, monastic officials, had dozens of excuses. The priory did business constantly with merchants, buying food, cloth, shoes, parchment, candles, garden tools, tack for horses, all the necessities of everyday life. The monks were landlords, owning almost the entire city, and any one of the physicians might be called to see a patient who was unable to walk to the hospital. So it was common to see monks in the streets, and Godwin, the sacrist, was not likely to be asked to explain what he was doing out of the monastery. Nevertheless, it was wise to be discreet, and he made sure he was not observed as he left the priory. He passed through the busy fair and went quickly along the main street to his Uncle Edmund's house. As he hoped, Edmund and Caris were out doing business, and he found his mother alone but for the servants. "This is a treat for a mother," she said, "to see you twice in one day, and it gives me a chance to feed you up." She poured him a big tankard of strong ale and told the cook to bring a plate of cold beef. "What happened in chapter?" she said. He told her the story. "I was in too much of a hurry," he said at the end. She nodded. "My father used to say, never call a meeting until the outcome is a foregone conclusion." Godwin smiled. "I must remember that." "All the same, I don't think you've done any harm." That was a relief. She was not going to be angry. "But I lost the argument," he said. You also established your position as leader of the reformist younger group, even though I made a fool of myself. Better than being a nonentity. He was not sure she was right about that, but, as usual, when he doubted the wisdom of his mother's advice, he did not challenge her, but resolved to think about it later. "Something very odd happened," he said, and he told her about Richard and Marjorie, leaving out the gross physical details. She was surprised. "Richard must be mad," she said. "The wedding will be called off if the Earl of Monmouth finds out that Marjorie isn't a virgin. Earl Rowland will be furious. Richard could be unfrocked." "But a lot of bishops have mistresses, don't they?" "That's different. A priest may have a housekeeper who is his wife in all but name. A bishop may have several. But to take the virginity of a noblewoman shortly before her wedding? Even the son of an earl might find it difficult to survive as a clergyman after that. What do you think I should do?" "Nothing. You've handled it perfectly so far." He glowed with pride. She added, "One day this information will be a powerful weapon. Just remember it." "There's one more thing. I wondered how Philemon had come across the loose stone, and it occurred to me that he might have used it initially as a hiding place. I was right, and I found a bracelet that Lady Philippa had lost." "Interesting," she said. "I have a strong feeling that Philemon will be useful to you. He'll do anything, you see. He has no scruples, no morals. My father had an associate who was always willing to do his dirty work, start rumors, spread poisonous gossip, foment strife. Such men can be invaluable." "So you don't think I should report the theft?" "Certainly not. Make him give the bracelet back if you think it's important. He can just say he found it while sweeping. But don't expose him. You'll reap the benefit, I guarantee." "So I should protect him, as you would a mad dog that mauls intruders. He's dangerous, but he's worth it." Chapter 10 On Thursday, Merthyn completed the door he was carving. He had finished work in the south aisle for the present. The scaffolding was in place. There was no need for him to make formwork for the masons, as Godwin and Thomas were determined to save money by trying Merthyn's method of building without it. So he returned to his carving, and realized there was little left to do. He spent an hour improving a wise virgin's hair, and another on a foolish virgin's silly smile. But he was not sure he was making them any better. He found it difficult to make decisions, because his mind kept wandering to Caris and Griselda. He had hardly been able to bring himself to speak to Caris all week. He felt so ashamed of himself. Every time he saw Caris, he thought of how he had embraced Griselda and kissed her, and done with her the most loving act of human life, a girl he did not like, let alone love. Although he had formerly spent many happy hours imagining the moment when he would do that with Caris, now the prospect was filled with dread. There was nothing wrong with Griselda. Well, there was, but that was not what disturbed him. He would have felt the same if it had been any woman other than Caris. He had taken away the meaning of the act by doing it with Griselda, and now he could not face the woman he loved. While he was staring at his work, trying to stop thinking about Caris and decide whether the doors were finished or not, Elizabeth Clark walked into the north porch. She was a pale, thin beauty of 25 with a cloud of fair curls. Her father had been the Bishop of Kingsbridge before Richard. He had lived, like Richard, in the bishop's palace at Shiring, but on his frequent visits to Kingsbridge he had fallen for a serving wench at the Bell, Elizabeth's mother. Because of her illegitimacy, Elizabeth was sensitive about her social position, alert to the least slight and quick to take offence. But Merthyn liked her because she was clever, and because when he was 18 she had kissed him and let him feel her breasts, which were high on her chest and flat, as if moulded from shallow cups, with nipples that hardened at the gentlest touch. Their romance had ended over something that seemed trivial to him and unforgivable to her, a joke he had made about randy priests. But he still liked her. She touched his shoulder and looked at the door. Her hand went to her mouth, and she drew in her breath. "They seem alive," she said. He was thrilled. Her praise was not lightly given. All the same, he felt an impulse to be modest. "It's only that I've made each one individual. On the old door, the virgins were identical." "It's more than that. They look as if they might step forward and talk to us." "Thank you. But it's so different from everything else in the cathedral. What will the monks say?" "Brother Thomas likes it." "What about the sacrist?" "Godwin. I don't know what he'll think. But if there's a fuss, I'll appeal to Prior Anthony, who won't want to commission another door and pay twice." "Well," she said thoughtfully, "the Bible doesn't say that they were all alike, of course. Just that five had the sense to get ready well in advance, and the other five left arrangements until the last minute and ended up missing the party. But what about Elfric?" "It's not for him. He's your master. He only cares about getting the money." She was not convinced. "The problem is that you're a better craftsman than he. That's been obvious for a couple of years, and everyone knows it. Elfric would never admit it, but that's why he hates you. He may make you regret this. You always see the black side." "Do I?" She was offended. "Well, we'll see if I'm right. I hope I'm wrong." She turned to go. "Elizabeth." "Yes?" "I'm really pleased you think it's good." She did not reply, but she seemed a bit mollified. She waved goodbye and left. Merthyn decided the door was finished. He wrapped it in coarse sacking. He would have to show it to Elfric, and now was as good a time as any. The rain had stopped, for a while at least. He got one of the labourers to help him carry the door. The builders had a technique for carrying heavy, awkward objects. They laid two stout poles on the ground, parallel, then placed boards crosswise on the poles in the centre to provide a firm base. They manhandled the object onto the boards. Then they stood between the poles, one man at each end, and lifted. The arrangement was called a stretcher, and it was also used for carrying sick people to the hospital. Even so, the door was very heavy. However, Merthyn was used to difficult lifting. Elfric had never allowed him to make an excuse of his slight stature, and the result was that he had become surprisingly strong. The two men reached Elfric's house and carried the door inside. Griselda was sitting in the kitchen. She seemed to be getting more voluptuous by the day. Her large breasts appeared to be growing even bigger. Merthyn hated to be at odds with people, so he tried to be friendly. "Do you want to see my door?" he said as they passed her. "Why would I want to look at a door? It's carved. The story of the wise and foolish virgins." She gave a humorless laugh. "Don't tell me about virgins." They carried it through to the yard. Merthyn did not understand women. Griselda had been cold to him ever since they had made love. If that was how she felt, why had she done it? She was making it clear she did not want to do it again. He could have reassured her that he felt the same way. In fact, he loathed the prospect. But that would be insulting, so he said nothing. They put down the stretcher, and Merthyn's helper left. Elfric was in the yard, his brawny body bent over a stack of timber, counting planks, tapping each beam with a piece of square-cut wood a couple of feet long, sticking his tongue into his cheek, as he did whenever he faced a mental challenge. He glared at Merthyn and carried on, so Merthyn said nothing, but unwrapped the door and stood it up against a pile of stone blocks. He was extraordinarily proud of what he had done. He had followed the traditional pattern, but at the same time he had done something original that made people gasp. He could hardly wait to see the door installed in the church. 47, Elfric said. Then he turned to Merthyn. I finished the door, Merthyn said proudly. What do you think? Elfric looked at the door for a moment. He had a big nose, and his nostrils twitched in surprise. Then, without warning, he hit Merthyn across the face with the stick he had been using to count. It was a solid piece of wood, and the blow was hard. Merthyn cried out in sudden agony, staggered back, and fell to the ground.
You piece of filth!
Alfric yelled. You defiled my daughter! Merthyn tried to sputter a protest, but his mouth was full of blood.
How dare you!
Alfric bellowed. As if at a signal, Alice appeared from inside the house.
Snake! She screamed. You slithered into our home and deflowered our little girl!
They were pretending to be spontaneous, but they must have planned this, Merthyn thought. He spat blood and said,
Deflowered? She was no virgin!
Alfric lashed out again with his improvised club. Merthyn rolled out of the way, but the blow landed painfully on his shoulder. Alice said,
How could you do this to Caris, my poor sister? When she finds out, it will break her heart.
Merthyn was stung into a response. And you'll be sure to tell her, won't you, you bitch? Well, you're not going to marry Griselda in secret, Alice said. Merthyn was astonished.
Marry? I'm not marrying her. She hates me.
With that, Griselda appeared.
I certainly don't want to marry you, she said, but I'll have to. I'm pregnant.
Merthyn stared at her.
That's not possible. We only did it once.
Alfric laughed harshly.
It only takes once, you young fool.
I'm still not marrying her. If you don't, you'll be sacked, Alfric said. You can't do that.
Why not?
I don't care. I'm not going to marry her.
Alfric dropped the club and picked up an axe.
Merthyn said, Jesus Christ!
Alice took a step forward.
Alfric, don't commit murder. Get out of the way, woman!
Alfric lifted the axe. Merthyn, still on the ground, scooted away in fear of his life. Alfric brought the axe down, not on Merthyn, but on his door. Merthyn shouted,
No!
The sharp blade sank into the face of the long-haired virgin and split the wood along the grain. Merthyn yelled,
Stop it!
Alfric lifted the axe again and brought it down even harder. It split the door in two. Merthyn got to his feet. To his horror, he felt his eyes fill with tears.
You have no right!
He was trying to shout, but his voice came out in a whisper. Alfric lifted the axe and turned towards him.
Stay back, boy. Don't tempt me.
Merthyn saw a mad light in Elfric's eye and backed away. Alfric brought the axe down on the door again. Merthyn stood and watched, with tears pouring down his face. Chapter 11 The two dogs, Skip and Scrap, greeted one another with joyful enthusiasm. They were from the same litter, though they did not look similar. Skip was a brown boy dog, and Scrap a small black female. Skip was a typical village dog, lean and suspicious, whereas the city-dwelling Scrap was plump and contented. It was 10 years since Gwenda had picked Scrap out of a litter of mongrel puppies on the floor of Caris's bedroom in the wool merchant's big house, the day Caris's mother died. Since then, Gwenda and Caris had become close friends. They met only 2 or 3 times a year, but they shared their secrets. Gwenda felt she could tell Caris everything, and the information would never get back to her parents or anyone else in Wigley. She assumed Caris felt the same. Because Gwenda did not talk to any other Kingsbridge girls, there could be no risk of her letting something slip in a careless moment. Gwenda arrived in Kingsbridge on the Friday of Fleece Fair week. Her father, Joby, went to the fairground in front of the cathedral to sell the furs of squirrels he had trapped in the forest near Wigley. Gwenda went straight to Caris's house, and the two dogs were reunited. As always, Gwenda and Caris talked about boys.
Merthyn is in a strange mood, Caris said. On Sunday he was his normal self, kissing me in church. Then, on Monday, he could hardly look me in the eye. He's feeling guilty about something, Gwenda said immediately. It's probably connected with Elizabeth Clark. She's always had her eye on him, though she's a cold bitch and much too old for him. Have you and Merthyn done it yet?
Done what?
You know, When I was little, I used to call it grunting, because that was the noise grown-ups made while they were doing it.
Oh, that!
No, not yet.
Why not?
I don't know.
Don't you want to?
Yes, but don't you worry about spending your life doing some man's bidding.
Gwenda shrugged.
I don't like the idea, but on the other hand, I don't worry about it.
What about you? Have you done it yet?
Not properly. I said yes to a boy from the next village, years ago, just to see what it was like. It's a nice warm glow, like drinking wine. That was the only time. But I'd let Wulfric do it any time he liked.
Wulfric? This is new.
Oh, no. I mean, I've known him since we were small, when he used to pull my hair and run away. Then one day, soon after Christmas, I looked at him as he came into church, and I realized he'd become a man. Well, not just a man, but a really gorgeous man. He had snow in his hair and a sort of mustard-colored scarf around his neck, and he just looked glowing.
Do you love him? Gwenda sighed. She did not know how to say what she felt. It was not just love. She thought about him all the time, and she did not know how she could live without him. She daydreamed about kidnapping him and locking him up in a hut deep in the forest so that he could never escape from her.
Well, the look on your face answers my question, Caris said. Does he love you?
Gwenda shook her head.
He never even speaks to me. I wish he'd do something to show that he knows who I am, even if it was only pulling my hair. But he's in love with Annet, the daughter of Perkin. She's a selfish cow, but he adores her. Her father and his are the two wealthiest men in the village. Her father raises laying hens and sells them, and his father has 50 acres.
You make it sound hopeless.
I don't know. What's hopeless? Annet might die. Wulfric might suddenly realize he's always loved me. My father might be made Earl and order him to marry me.
Caris smiled. You're right. Love is never hopeless. I'd like to see this boy.
Gwenda stood up. I was hoping you'd say that. Let's go and find him.
They left the house, the dogs following at their heels. The rainstorms that had lashed the town earlier in the week had given way to occasional showers, but the main street was still a stream of mud. Because of the fair, the mud was mixed with animal droppings, rotten vegetables, and all the litter and filth of 1,000 visitors. As they splashed through the disgusting puddles, Caris asked about Gwenda's family.
The cow died, Gwenda said. Pa needs to buy another, but I don't know how he's going to do it. He only has a few squirrel furs to sell.
A cow costs 12 shillings this year, Caris said with concern. That's 144 silver pennies. Caris always did arithmetic in her head. She had learned Arabic numbers from Buonaventura Caroli, and she said that made it easy.
For the last few winters, that cow has kept us alive, especially the little ones.
The pain of extreme hunger was familiar to Gwenda. Even with the cow to give milk, 4 of Ma's babies had died. No wonder Philemon had longed to be a monk, she thought. It was worth almost any sacrifice to have hearty meals provided every day without fail.
Caris said, What will your father do?
Something underhand. It's difficult to steal a cow. You can't slip it into your satchel, but he'll have a crafty scheme. Gwenda was sounding more confident than she felt. Pa was dishonest, but not clever. He would do anything he could, legal or not, to get another cow, but he might just fail. They passed through the priory gates into the wide fairground. The traders were wet and miserable on the 6th day of bad weather. They had exposed their stock to the rain and got little in return. Gwenda felt awkward. She and Caris almost never talked about the disparity in wealth between the two families. Every time Gwenda visited, Caris would quietly give her a present to take home, a cheese, a smoked fish, a bolt of cloth, a jar of honey. Gwenda would thank her, and she was always profoundly grateful, but no more would be said.
When Pa tried to make her take advantage of Caris's trust by stealing from the house, Gwenda would argue that she would then be unable to visit again, whereas this way she came home with something 2 or 3 times a year. Even Pa could see the sense of that. Gwenda looked for the stall where Perkin would be selling his hens. Annett would probably be there, and wherever Annett was, Wulfric would not be far away. Gwenda was right. There was Perkin, fat and sly, greasily polite to his customers, curt to everyone else. Annett was carrying a tray of eggs, smiling coquettishly, the tray pulling her dress tight against her breasts, her fair hair straying from her hat in wisps that played around her pink cheeks and her long neck. And there was Wulfric, looking like an archangel who had lost his way and wandered among humankind by mistake.
"There he is,"
Gwenda murmured. "The tall one with..." "I can tell which one he is," Caris said.
"He looks good enough to eat. You see what I mean? He's a bit young, isn't he? 16. I'm 18. Annett is 18, too."
"All right."
"I know what you're thinking," Gwenda said. "He's too handsome for me."
"No. Handsome men never fall for ugly women, do they?
You're not ugly. I've seen myself in a glass."
The memory was painful, and Gwenda grimaced. "I cried when I realized what I looked like. I have a big nose, and my eyes are too close together. I resemble my father."
Caris protested. "You have beautiful, soft brown eyes and wonderful thick hair. But I'm not in Wulfric's class."
Wulfric was standing side on to Gwenda and Caris, giving them a good view of his carved profile. They both admired him for a moment. Then he turned, and Gwenda gasped. The other side of his face was completely different, bruised and swollen, with one eye closed. She ran up to him.
"What happened to you?"
she cried. He was startled. "Oh, hello, Gwenda. I had a fight." He half turned away, obviously embarrassed.
"Who with?"
"Some squire of the Earl's."
"You're hurt."
He looked impatient. "Don't worry, I'm fine." He did not understand why she was concerned, of course. Perhaps he even thought she was reveling in his misfortune. Then Caris spoke.
"Which squire?" she said.
Wulfric looked at her with interest, realizing from her dress that she was a wealthy woman. "His name is Ralph Fitzgerald."
"Oh, Merthin's brother,"
Caris said.
"Was he hurt?"
"I broke his nose." Wulfric looked proud.
"Weren't you punished?"
"A night in the stocks." Gwenda gave a little cry of anguish.
"Poor you."
"It wasn't so bad. My brother made sure no one pelted me."
"Even so."
Gwenda was horrified. The idea of being imprisoned in any way seemed to her the worst kind of torture. Annett finished with a customer and joined in the conversation.
"Oh, it's you, Gwenda," she said coldly.
Wulfric might be oblivious to Gwenda's feelings, but Annett was not, and she treated Gwenda with a mixture of hostility and scorn.
"Wulfric fought a squire who insulted me," she said, unable to conceal her satisfaction. "He was just like a knight in a ballad."
Gwenda said sharply, "I wouldn't want him to get his face hurt for my sake."
"Fortunately, that's not very likely, is it?"
Annett smiled triumphantly. Caris said, "One never knows what the future may hold." Annett looked at her, startled by the interruption, and showed surprise that Gwenda's companion was so expensively dressed. Caris took Gwenda's arm.
"Such a pleasure to meet you, Wigley folk," she said graciously. "Goodbye."
They walked on. Gwenda giggled.
"You were terribly condescending to Annett.
She annoyed me. Her kind give women a bad name.
She was so pleased that Wulfric got beaten up for her sake. I'd like to poke out her eyes."
Caris said thoughtfully,
"Apart from his good looks, what is he actually like?"
"Strong, proud, loyal. Just the type to get into a fight on someone else's behalf. But he's the kind of man who will provide tirelessly for his family year in and year out until the day he drops dead."
Caris said nothing.
Gwenda said, "He doesn't appeal to you, does he?" You make him sound a bit dull. If you'd grown up with my father, you wouldn't think a good provider was dull.
I know. Caris squeezed Gwenda's arm. I think he's wonderful for you. And to prove it, I'm going to help you get him.
Gwenda was not expecting that.
How? Come with me.
They left the fairground and walked to the north end of the town. Caris led Gwenda to a small house in a side street near St. Mark's Parish Church.
A wise woman lives here, she said.
Leaving the dogs outside, they ducked through a low doorway. The single, narrow downstairs room was divided by a curtain. In the front half were a chair and a bench. The fireplace had to be at the back, Gwenda thought, and she wondered why someone would want to hide whatever went on in the kitchen. The room was clean, and there was a strong smell, herby and slightly acid, hardly a perfume, but not unpleasant. Caris called out, "Matty, it's me." After a moment, a woman of about 40 pulled aside the curtain and came through. She had grey hair and pale indoor skin. She smiled when she saw Caris. Then she gave Gwenda a hard look and said, "I see your friend is in love, but the boy hardly speaks to her." Gwenda gasped.
"How did you know?"
Matty sat on the chair heavily. She was stout and short of breath.
"People come here for three reasons: sickness, revenge, and love. You look healthy, and you're too young for revenge, so you must be in love. And the boy must be indifferent to you, otherwise you wouldn't need my help."
Gwenda glanced at Caris, who looked pleased, and said, "I told you she was wise." The two girls sat on the bench and looked expectantly at the woman. Matty went on,
"He lives close to you, probably in the same village, but his family are wealthier than yours."
"All true."
Gwenda was amazed. No doubt Matty was guessing, but she was so accurate it seemed as if she must have second sight.
"Is he handsome?"
"Very.
But he's in love with the prettiest girl in the village."
"If you like that type."
"And her family, too, is wealthier than yours."
"Yes."
Matty nodded.
"A familiar story. I can help you, but you must understand something. I have nothing to do with the spirit world. Only God can work miracles."
Gwenda was puzzled. Everyone knew that the spirits of the dead controlled all of life's hazards. If they were pleased with you, they would guide rabbits to your traps, give you healthy babies, and make the sun shine on your ripening corn. But if you did something to anger them, they could put worms in your apples, cause your cow to give birth to a deformed calf, and make your husband impotent. Even the physicians at the priory admitted that prayers to the saints were more efficacious than their medicines. Matty went on,
"Don't despair. I can sell you a love potion."
"I'm sorry. I have no money."
"I know, but your friend Caris is extraordinarily fond of you, and she wants you to be happy. She came here prepared to pay for the potion. However, you must administer it correctly. Can you get the boy alone for an hour?"
"I'll find a way."
"Put the potion in his drink. Within a short time he will become amorous. That's when you must be alone with him. If there is another girl in sight, he may fall for her instead. So keep him away from other women and be very sweet to him. He will think you the most desirable woman in the world. Kiss him. Tell him he's wonderful and, if you want, make love to him. After a while, he will sleep. When he wakes up, he will remember that he spent the happiest hour of his life in your arms, and he'll want to do it again as soon as he can."
"But won't I need another dose?"
"No. The second time, your love and desire and femininity will be enough. A woman can make any man blissfully happy if he gives her the chance."
The very thought made Gwenda feel lustful. "I can't wait.
Then let's make up the mixture."
Matty heaved herself out of the chair.
"You can come behind the curtain," she said.
Gwenda and Caris followed her.
"It's only there for the ignorant."
The kitchen had a clean stone floor and a big fireplace equipped with stands and hooks for cooking and boiling.
far more than one woman would need for her own food. There was a heavy old table, stained and scorched but scrubbed clean, a shelf with a row of pottery jars, and a locked cupboard, presumably containing the more precious ingredients used in Matty's potions. Hanging on the wall was a large slate with numbers and letters scratched on it, presumably recipes.
"Why do you need to hide all this behind a curtain?" Gwenda said.
"A man who makes ointments and medicines is called an apothecary, but a woman who does the same runs the risk of being called a witch. There's a woman in town called Crazy Nell who goes around shouting about the devil. Friar Murdo has accused her of heresy. Nell is mad, it's true, but there's no harm in her. All the same, Murdo is insisting on a trial. Men like to kill a woman every now and again, and Murdo will give them an excuse and collect their pennies afterwards as alms. That's why I always tell people that only God works miracles. I don't conjure spirits. I just use the herbs of the forest and my powers of observation."
While Matty talked, Caris was moving about the kitchen as freely as if she were at home. She put a mixing bowl and a vial on the table. Matty handed her a key, and she opened the cupboard.
"Put 3 drops of essence of poppies into a spoonful of distilled wine," Matty said. "We must be careful not to make the mixture over strong, or he will go to sleep too soon."
Gwenda was astonished. "Are you going to make the potion, Caris? I sometimes help Matty. Don't say anything to Petronilla. She would disapprove."
"I wouldn't tell her if her hair was on fire."
Caris's aunt disliked Gwenda, probably for the same reason she would disapprove of Matty. They were both low class, and such things mattered to Petronilla. But why was Caris, the daughter of a wealthy man, working like an apprentice in the kitchen of a side street medicine woman? While Caris made up the mixture, Gwenda recalled that her friend had always been curious about illness and cures. As a little girl, Caris had wanted to be a physician, not understanding that only priests were allowed to study medicine. Gwenda remembered her saying after her mother had died, "But why do people have to fall sick?" Mother Cecilia had told her it was because of sin. Edmund had said that no one really knew. Neither response had satisfied Caris. Perhaps she was still seeking the answer here in Matty's kitchen. Caris poured the liquid into a tiny jar, stoppered it, and bound the stopper tightly with cord, tying the ends in a knot. Then she handed the jar to Gwenda. Gwenda tucked it into the leather purse attached to her belt. She wondered how on earth she was going to get Wulfric on his own for an hour. She had glibly said that she would find a way, but, now that she had the love potion in her possession, the task seemed nearly impossible. He showed signs of restlessness if she merely spoke to him. He wanted to be with Annet any free time he had. What reason would Gwenda give for needing to be alone with him? "I want to show you a place where we can get wild duck eggs." But why would she show him and not her father? Wulfric was a little naive, but not stupid. He would know she was up to something. Caris gave Matty 12 silver pennies, 2 weeks' wages for Pa. Gwenda said, "Thank you, Caris. I hope you'll come to my wedding." Caris laughed. "That's what I like to see. Confidence." They left Matty and headed back to the fair. Gwenda decided to begin by finding out where Wulfric was staying. His family were too well off to claim poverty, so they could not stay free at the Priory. They would probably be lodging in a tavern. She could just casually ask him, or his brother, and follow up with a question about the standard of accommodation, as if she were interested to know which of the town's many inns was the best. A monk passed by, and Gwenda realized, with a guilty start, that she had not even thought about trying to see her brother Philemon. Pa would not visit him, for they had hated one another for years, but Gwenda was fond of him. She knew that he was sly, untruthful, and malicious, but all the same, he loved her. They had been through many hungry winters together. She would seek him out later, she resolved, after she had seen Wulfric again. But before she and Caris reached the fairground, they met Gwenda's father.
Joby was near the priory gates, outside the bell. With him was a rough-looking man in a yellow tunic with a pack on his back, and a brown cow. He waved Gwenda over.
"I found a cow," he said.
Gwenda looked more closely. It was 2 years old and thin, with a bad-tempered look, but it appeared healthy.
"It seems fine," she said. "This is Sim Chapman," he said, jerking a thumb at the yellow tunic.
A chapman travelled from village to village selling small necessities, needles, buckles, hand mirrors, combs. He might have stolen the cow, but that would not bother Pa if the price was right. Gwenda said to her father,
"Where did you get the money?"
"I'm not paying, exactly," he replied, looking shifty.
Gwenda had expected him to have some scheme.
"What then?"
"It's more of a swap."
"What are you giving him in exchange for the cow?"
"You," said Pa.
"Don't be silly," she said,
and then she felt a loop of rope dropped over her head and tightened around her body, pinning her arms to her sides. She felt bewildered. This could not be happening. She struggled to free herself, but Sim just pulled the rope tighter.
"Now don't make a fuss," Pa said.
She could not believe they were serious.
"What do you think you're doing?" she said incredulously. "You can't sell me, you fool."
"Sim needs a woman, and I need a cow," Pa said. "It's very simple."
Sim spoke for the first time.
"She's ugly enough, your daughter."
"This is ridiculous," Gwenda said.
Sim smiled at her.
"Don't worry, Gwenda," he said. "I'll be good to you, as long as you behave yourself and do as you're told."
They meant it, Gwenda saw. They actually thought they could make this exchange. A cold needle of fear entered her heart as she realized it might even happen. Caris spoke up.
"This joke has gone on long enough," she said in a loud, clear voice. "Release Gwenda immediately."
Sim was not intimidated by her air of command.
"And who are you to give orders?"
"My father is alderman of the parish guild."
"But you're not," Sim said. "And even if you were, you'd have no authority over me or my friend Joby."
"You can't trade a girl for a cow."
"Why not?" said Sim. "It's my cow, and the girl is his daughter."
Their raised voices attracted the attention of passers-by, who stopped to stare at the girl tied up with a rope. Someone said,
"What's happening?"
Another replied, "He sold his daughter for a cow." Gwenda saw a look of panic cross her father's face. He was wishing he had done this up a quiet alley. But he was not smart enough to have foreseen the public reaction. Gwenda realized the bystanders might be her only hope. Caris waved to a monk who came out of the priory gates.
"Brother Godwin," she called, "come and settle an argument, please."
She looked triumphantly at Sim. "The priory has jurisdiction over all bargains agreed at the fleece fair," she said. "Brother Godwin is the sacrist. I think you'll have to accept his authority." Godwin said, "Hello, Cousin Caris. What's the matter?" Sim grunted with disgust.
"Your cousin, is he?"
Godwin gave him a frosty look. "Whatever the dispute is here, I shall try to give a fair judgment as a man of God. You can depend on me for that, I hope."
"And very glad to hear it, sir," Sim said, becoming obsequious.
Joby was equally oily.
"I know you, brother. My son Philemon is devoted to you. You've been the soul of kindness to him."
"All right, enough of that," Godwin said. "What's going on?"
Caris said, "Joby here wants to sell Gwenda for a cow. Tell him he can't."
Joby said, "She's my daughter, sir, and she's 18 years old and a maid, so she's mine to do with what I will." Godwin said, "All the same, it seems a shameful business, selling your children." Joby became pathetic.
"I wouldn't do it, sir. Only I've 3 more at home, and I'm a landless labourer with no means to feed the children through the winter unless I have a cow, and her old one has died."
There was a sympathetic murmur from the growing crowd. They knew about winter hardship,
and the extremes to which a man might have to go to feed his family, Gwenda began to despair. Sim said, "Shameful you may think it, Brother Godwin, but is it a sin?" He spoke as if he already knew the answer, and Gwenda guessed he might have had this argument before in a different place. With obvious reluctance, Godwin said, "The Bible does appear to sanction selling your daughter into slavery. The book of Exodus, chapter 21. "Well, there you are, then," said Joby. "It's a Christian act." Caris was outraged. "The book of Exodus," she said scornfully. One of the bystanders joined in. "We are not the children of Israel," she said. She was a small, chunky woman with an underbite that gave her jaw a determined look. Although dressed poorly, she was assertive. Gwenda recognized her as Madge, the wife of Mark Webber. "There is no slavery today," Madge said. Sim said, "Then what of apprentices who get no pay and may be beaten by their masters? Or novice monks and nuns? Or those who skivvy for bed and board in the palaces of the nobility?" Madge said, "Their life may be hard, but they can't be bought and sold. Can they, Brother Godwin?" "I don't say that the trade is lawful," Godwin responded. "I studied medicine at Oxford, not law. But I can find no reason in Holy Scripture, or the teachings of the Church, to say that what these men are doing is a sin." He looked at Caris and shrugged. "I'm sorry, cousin." Madge Webber folded her arms across her chest. "Well, Chapman, how are you going to take the girl out of town?" "At the end of a rope," he said. "Same way I brought the cow in." "Ah, but you didn't have to get the cow past me and these people." Gwenda's heart leaped with hope. She was not sure how many of the bystanders supported her. But if it came to a fight, they were more likely to side with Madge, who was a townswoman, than with Sim, an outsider. "I've dealt with obstinate women before," Sim said, and his mouth twisted as he spoke. "They've never given me much trouble." Madge put her hand on the rope. "Perhaps you've been lucky." He snatched the rope away. "Keep your hands off my property, and you won't get hurt." Deliberately, Madge put a hand on Gwenda's shoulder. Sim shoved Madge roughly, and she staggered back, but there was a murmur of protest from the crowd. A bystander said, "You wouldn't do that if you'd seen her husband." There was a ripple of laughter. Gwenda recalled Madge's husband Mark, a gentle giant. If only he would show up. But it was John Constable who arrived, his well-developed nose for trouble bringing him to any crowd almost as soon as it gathered. "We'll have no shoving," he said. "Are you causing trouble, Chapman?" Gwenda became hopeful again. Chapman had a bad reputation, and the constable was assuming Sim was the cause of the trouble. Sim turned obsequious, something he could obviously do quicker than changing his hat. "Beg pardon, Master Constable," he said, "but when a man has paid an agreed price for his purchase, he must be allowed to leave Kingsbridge with his goods intact." "Of course," John had to agree. A market town depended on its reputation for fair dealing. "But what have you bought?"
"This girl."
"Oh." John looked thoughtful. "Who sold her?"
"I did," said Joby. "I'm her father."
Sim went on,
"And this woman with the big chin threatened to stop me taking the girl away."
"So I did," said Madge, "for I've never heard of a woman being bought and sold in Kingsbridge Market, and nor has anyone else around here." Joby said, "A man may do as he will with a child of his own." He looked around the crowd appealingly. "Is there anyone here who would disagree with that?" Gwenda knew that no one would. Some people treated their children kindly and some harshly, but all were agreed that the father must have absolute power over the child. She burst out angrily,
"You wouldn't stand there, deaf and dumb, if you had a father like him. How many of you were sold by your parents? How many of you were made to steal when you were children, and had hands small enough to slide into folks' wallets?"
Joby started to look worried.
"'She's raving now, Master Constable,' he said. "'No child of mine ever stole.'
"'Never mind that,' said John. "'Everyone listen to me. "'I shall make a ruling on this. "'Those who disagree with my decision can complain to the prior. "'If there's any shoving by anyone or any other kind of rough stuff, "'I shall arrest everyone involved in it. "'I hope that's clear.'
He looked around belligerently. No one spoke. They were eager to hear his decision. He went on, "'I know of no reason why this trade is unlawful. Therefore Sim Chapman is allowed to go his way with the girl.'
Joby said, "'I told you so. Didn't—'
"'Shut your damn mouth, Joby, you fool,' said the constable,